Hello, this is Dr. Leo Stauder with Biology on the Beach. We're here in beautiful Dania Beach, Florida. Nice waves behind us. Little seagull flying overhead. I got my feet in the sand. We're going to continue talking about chemistry today. This will be chemistry part two. We're going to be continuing with talking about the redox reactions. Now, when we look at the concept of a redox reaction, really redox is a combination of two words. One is reduction, the other one is oxidation. So reduction is a term that we use when something happens to an atom, and oxidation is also a term we use when something happens to an atom. If an atom gains an electron, we call it reduced. If we say that an atom has lost an electron, we say it's oxidized. So if we look at a ion, if it's a positive ion, we know that it has lost an electron or it has gained one. Positive ion. All right, it's positive because the protons are going to be in more abundance than the electrons. Therefore, a positive ion has lost an electron. So if it loses an electron, then we would call that ion oxidized. And we can also have a negative ion, such as chlorine. Chlorine is going to be a negative ion, Cl negative 1. That would have done what? Added or subtracted an electron from it to become the chlorine negative ion. That's exactly it. We have added an electron, that's why we're more negative, right? So if we have gained an electron, we call this to be reduced. So the chloride ion would be considered reduced. The way we remember this is by remembering the mnemonic, Leo the lion goes GER. L-E-O stands for lose electron oxidize, and GER stands for gain electron reduced. So think of the oxidation and reduction, the redox reaction, as one electron gaining and one electron losing, or one atom gaining an electron, one losing an electron. Now, if we think of the electron going from one atom to another atom, we know that the atom that has lost the electron is called oxidized, and the one that gained the electron is called reduced. But the path of the electron, until it becomes reduced, until it becomes part of the atom, that path of the electron is said to be a free radical. And a free radical is going to be a free electron. Now, free radicals can have their effect on the body. They can usually have a negative effect, because as the free radical goes to its intended atom for to be reduced, it can cause tissue destruction along the way. So that's why we tend to want to, in our bodies, to be able to decrease the electron flying off. In other words, to decrease free radicals. And how do we decrease free radicals? Well, we don't want them to oxidize. So a real good example of oxidation would be rust. If you look at a car that has rusted, the reason it's rusted is because the iron ions, or the iron parts in there, have become oxidized. So as they start to lose their electrons, the iron starts to lose its structure. It starts to break down, and it starts to become rusty, and the steel becomes now no longer usable, becomes brittle. It's not able to actually be a good car any longer, because that has oxidized. Well, how do you decrease oxidation in a car? Right, you paint it, right? If you have painted metal, that's going to be allowing it not to oxidize. But if you get it wet underneath the paint, then the water, as it interacts with the iron, will cause oxidation and will cause the rust. So really, then, we could say that paint is an antioxidant. Also, too, if we look at our bodies, or let's just say, let's look at some physical thing like, let's say, an orange, or no, better, a banana. Let's think of a banana. You open a banana up, take off the peeling, and keep it outside. Keep it out in the open air for a while. eventually that banana is going to become brown. That brownness tells us that it has lost electrons, or that the banana is starting to spoil. But we know it in scientific terms as it's starting to oxidize. So we know that what we can do is put certain substances on the banana. We could certainly paint it, and then it wouldn't oxidize. But that wouldn't be very tasty. We could, however, put lemon juice on it. If we put lemon juice on the banana, we would find that it would stay fresher longer. Because lemon juice is a anti-what? You got it? Antioxidant. It decreases the free radical formation. It decreases the ability of the atoms of the banana to actually have their electrons being stolen. So it keeps the electrons in the banana, so the banana does not spoil, it does not brown as much. This would be the same thing that the antioxidant vitamin C does for our bodies. It decreases the amount of free radical formation, therefore it keeps us younger longer. Any of the antioxidants, that's how they're going to be functioning. They're going to be really laying on the grenade so that we don't get the oxidation reaction. So it's good for us to take antioxidants because of that. Now let's talk about chemical bonds. There's basically three kinds of chemical bonds. We have a covalent bond, we have an ionic bond, we also have a hydrogen bond. Now, atoms are held together by chemical bonds. So when we hold two atoms together, this is called a molecule. So these bonds create molecules. So we take one atom and allow it to be combined with another atom, and we get a molecule. So molecules are held together by chemical bonds, which would be two or more of these atoms. So we think of, for instance, the hydrogen gas. Hydrogen gas is going to be two hydrogens put together, and that's going to be considered a molecule of hydrogen gas. Or we think of water. Water is going to be H2O. It's going to be two hydrogens with one oxygen put together. So that's going to give us the water molecule. So when we look at the first kind of chemical bonds, we see it's going to be a covalent bond. Covalent. Now, the co part is a clue to what it does. It cooperates. So it's two atoms that cooperate with each other, that cohabitate with each other, that are in a coeducational system with each other, that are coordinated with each other. The co part tells you that it's going to be a bond that's going to be mutually beneficial to both of the atoms. So it's going to be a sharing, in other words, it's going to be occurring. When we look at the covalent bond, we see we have two types. We have a polar and a non-polar. Now the concept of polar is real simple. It means that there's going to be a negative or positive charge on that molecule. Now this is distinct from when we talked about the ionic. Remember when we talked about ions? We said ions are going to be positive or negative charged particles. But a positively or negatively charged atom is considered polar. So polar is going to be that concept of when the molecule is going to be either positively or negatively charged. Nonpolar, however, will be just the opposite, where you do not have a charge on the molecule. So nonpolar, no charge, or polar, charge. And think of polar as sort of like if you think of the Earth, and it has the two poles, the North and South Pole, and we know that a magnetic force is created between the North and South Poles. So we think of that polar as being positive and negative. It's one way of thinking of it. Or we could think about a little polar bear and how cute they are. So let's say we're on the frozen tundra and we see a cute little polar bear. We go up to it and we start to hug it, and it's a real positive experience. But then, not far from any kind of small polar bear is a what? Yes, is a not-so-kind big mother bear. She's going to be looking at you with not a very positive expression on her face, nor is she going to be appreciating you hugging her little baby bear. So that will be a decidedly negative experience, you have to admit. So the positive experience of the little bear in your hands is mixed with that negative experience of the polar bear mother coming after you. that's going to be both positive experience, and the negative experience is going to be a polar experience. So when we look at the covalent bonds, we see we're going to be having these two kinds of bonds. They're going to be polar and nonpolar bonds. When we look at the ionic bond now is going to be composed of ions, and we know what ions are. They're positively or negatively charged atoms. So when we put them together, what we see is that one of the components, one of the atoms, is going to become an ion, and the other component is going to become an ion. Since we're shifting electrons back and forth, one's going to become more positive, one's going to become more negative. So there's going to be a sharing, yes, of electrons, but more, there's going to be a give or take of electrons. That's going to be our ionic bond. It's a fairly weak bond. Our hydrogen bond is going to be our weakest bond. And hydrogen bonds are going to be really sort of attractions and really not a physical exchange. It's more that the hydrogen bond would, like, a portion of the molecule would be positive or polar, and the other part of the molecule might be negative or polar. And that positive part of one element or one molecule will be attracted to the negative part of the other molecule. But they don't really exchange any electrons. That's why it's such a weak bond. It's just really just an attraction. So let's describe more in detail what a covalent bond is. The best example of a covalent bond is going to be if we were to put together like a typical hydrocarbon. What do we mean by hydrocarbon? Well, we mean that we're going to have hydrogen in that molecule. We also mean that we're going to be having carbon in that molecule. So we have a hydrocarbon. So when we look at carbon, the atom carbon or the element carbon, we see that we will have the element carbon as the atomic number of 6. So the element carbon has the atomic number of 6, as you remember. That tells us that we have 6 protons in the nucleus, 6 neutrons in the nucleus, and then we would have 6 electrons in its shells. So what we're looking at here is a element of carbon, and we see that we have purple little balls that represent the element carbon. We see that on the outside of carbon is going to be 4 electrons. On the first shell of carbon coming out from the nucleus, we're going to have 2 electrons. And we mentioned that that's the way it works. The first shell has to have 2 electrons for the shell to be fulfilled. The next shell has a capacity of 8 electrons. So if we look at the second shell of carbon, we see the outer shell is going to need 4 more electrons for it to feel complete. So these are general rules. First rule is that the first shell out from the nucleus needs 2 electrons. The second shell out from the nucleus wants and needs at least 8 electrons. If it only has 4, that means it's going to be reactive, as we talked about previous. We said that the hydrogen was reactive, whereas the helium was not reactive, if you remember. And we said helium wasn't reactive because it had 2 electrons in its outer shell, whereas hydrogen is very reactive because it has only 1 and it needs another one. Well, now we're seeing the representation of hydrogen here. Hydrogen needs another electron in its outer shell, so it's going to want to share those electrons that are in the outside of carbon. They want to share 1 electron. So for us to fulfill the last shell of carbon, we need 4 hydrogens. 4 hydrogens will give us 4 additional electrons. And this then will be a sharing, if you will, of electrons between carbon and hydrogen. This then will give us a hydrocarbon. One example of a hydrocarbon is methane. And you know methane as, sorry, excuse me. You know methane as common gas. So if an individual has lots of gas, you can tell them now that they really have lots of methane. And you can even, if you want to, draw the methane molecule out for them. I'm sure they'll be very happy with that. So if we look at CH4, we see that this is almost a perfect molecule because it has symmetry. We have one primary atom called carbon in the middle. We have four atoms of hydrogen on the outside, making our hydrocarbon. Now we can write this in a number of ways if we have a covalent bond. We can either write it, as we said, CH4, knowing that there's one carbon and there's four H's or four hydrogens. Or we can also use a chemistry shorthand, where we have the C in the middle, and we have a line or dash that represents the covalent bond. So one dash lets us know that we're using covalent bonds. We can also write it with dots. The dots would represent how many electrons are being shared between the two atoms. So you have carbon sharing two electrons with one hydrogen as you go all the way around the hydrocarbon. We can also use a model, a stick model, where we have carbon in the middle, and then we have its four bonding sites being attached to four hydrogens. So we get a sort of a 3D view of that. We can also use a balloon model, where we sort of push out balloons from the center of the carbon and make the balloons come out of the hydrogens. So any of these are helpful. Probably the one that we use the most is the one with the dashes to represent a covalent bond. So what we take away from this is that we see that the covalent bond is going to be more of a sharing of the electrons. Now when we look at the ionic bond, one of the best examples of ionic bonds is going to be sodium and chloride put together. Sodium, as you remember, had the atomic number of 11, and chlorine had the atomic number of 17. So when we look at the atomic number of 11, we know that we have 11 protons in the nucleus of sodium. We have 12 neutrons. Well, for our purposes, we would say that we have 11 neutrons, but in actuality we have 12. So just keep it simple and say that we have 11 protons in the nucleus for sodium. And remember that sodium's symbol is going to be Na. Remember, because it's found in nature. So we have Na and 11 protons in its nucleus. For for the nucleus of chlorine, we have 17 protons. So if we have 11 protons, we know we have how many electrons? Exactly, 11. So the protons are going to equal the electrons. When we look at chlorine, we have 17 protons, so we're going to be having chlorine have 17 electrons as well. So when we look at sodium and chlorine, we see that they have the same number of protons as electrons. Now, we discussed that our first shell coming off from the nucleus should have two electrons. And indeed, both of these do. The next shell coming off for sodium should have a maximum of 8. And indeed, that's the case. So now we got two in our first shell. We have 8 in our next shell. That means we have 10 electrons total. To get us to 11 electrons, we have to have that one electron in the outer shell. Now, as we discussed, or we didn't really go this far, in our second shell, we're going to say that it's most beneficial to have 8 electrons in our next shell. Now, that's for our purposes. So we're going to say that it would be better for sodium to have 7 more electrons in its outer shell. Or sodium could accomplish the same thing by giving up one of his outer electrons. So if sodium gives up the outer electron, now he no longer has an outer shell. That means that he now has an outer shell with 8 electrons because he gave up that one electron on the outside. So in effect, sodium feels fulfilled. Now if we can find some way of giving that electron to someone else and they'll feel fulfilled, then it's a marriage made in heaven. Wouldn't you agree? So we look at chlorine, we see that chlorine has 17 protons, its first shell has 2. So now we're left with 15 more electrons, right? The next shell is going to be 8. So now we're left with 7 more electrons. Because that's 2 in the first shell, and then it's 8 in the next shell. So its third shell has to have a total of how many electrons? Good job, 7. So if we have 7 in the outer shell, and we know we would prefer 8, what better way to get that extra electron than to take it from sodium? So sodium's going to feel happy because she feels fulfilled on the outside. And chlorine's going to feel happy because he's fulfilled on the outside because he's got 8 electrons. So it's a give and take, if you will, of electrons that makes an ionic bond. Because when sodium gives up its one electron on the outside, he or she changes now to a positive ion. And chlorine, because he took that one electron, he now is a negative atom. So now you have a give and take of electrons, and also you have each of the elements changing their polarities, right? They're becoming ions now. And that's the reason we call it an ionic bond. And the best example is what you just saw, which is NaCl, which is chlorine and sodium mixed together. And that, of course, is common table salt. So common table salt is a really good example of an ionic bond. Now, as we mentioned with the covalent bonds, that they're either polar or nonpolar, the best example of a polar covalent bond would be a water molecule. Now, water molecule is going to be composed of both hydrogen, two hydrogens, and also one oxygen. So we're going to be looking at that in just a moment. But a nonpolar covalent bond would be two hydrogen atoms bonded together. If you bond two hydrogen atoms together, they are sharing their electrons, but that molecule will not have a charge. Therefore, we'll call it nonpolar. And the ionic bond, of course, would be the sodium with chlorine, common table salt. A hydrogen bond example, now get this one. A hydrogen bond example will be two water molecules bumping up against each other. So remember the distinction here. A polar covalent bond, good example of that, is a water molecule. But a hydrogen bond, good example, is two water molecules bumping up against each other. So think about it. The polar covalent example, a water molecule, tells us that that water molecule, one side of it is going to be positive, the other side is going to be negative. So it is polar in itself. Take that polar molecule, water, and put it with another polar molecule called water. So now we have two molecules of water. They are going to have the positive and negatives on the outside of them, so they're going to be able to bond, if you will, with those attractions. The positive will go with the will go with the negative. The negative will go with the positive. And you'll see them sort of bumping into each other. That's why we call it such a weak bond. So when we look at the hydrogen bond, or we look at the water molecule, we can see that, and we use that little balloon model, we can see that it sort of looks like a kid with one of those old-time hats on. That has like the little earmuffs above his head, you know. And the earmuffs, or ears, are going to be really positives. And the rest of the molecule is going to be more negative. So the hydrogens are going to be the more positive. The negative part is going to be the oxygen. Now, the reason that we have the hydrogens being more positive is because the electrons spend more time going around the oxygen. So that makes oxygen more negative. And because the electrons spend more time around the oxygen, they are going to be spending less time around the hydrogen. Therefore, hydrogen is going to be relatively more positive due to its proton. So if we think of like sort of Mickey Mouse, Mickey Mouse's ears would be very positive because he listens a lot. But sometimes he uses a high voice, and that's sort of a negative. So his mouth or the rest of his body would be more negative. So picture Minnie and Mickey getting together. If they were just floating in space just with their heads, you would see their ears going towards each other, but then they're going to repel each other because that's negative with negative. What would have to happen is Minnie would have to turn around so that her mouth would be close to Mickey's ear and whispering into his ear, let's say. And then that would move around again, and then maybe Mickey's mouth might be close to Minnie's ear and whispering to her. So that's the way water molecules work. They go back and forth and around like that. Very weak bonds, though. There's not a sharing of electrons. And speaking of Minnie and Mickey, turns out that there was a recent tragedy here in Dania Beach, in fact, and just the other day, where Minnie almost drowned, and Mickey brought her to the shore of Dania Beach, just out here, and he performed CPR on her, and he also did, mouse to mouse, and he saved her, so it was a good thing. So the structures of the atoms determines how they will bond. Atoms with 1, 2, or 3 electrons in their outer shell tend to lose their electrons, such as sodium. Like sodium only has one atom or one electron in its outer shell, so it would tend to lose that guy. Okay, they become then what kind of atoms if they lose their electrons? Positive, very good. On the other end of the scale, we can look at atoms with 5 or 7 electrons in their outer shell. These guys tend to want to add more electrons too, so they can get to their eight electrons, right? So they'll tend to become more negative ions because their outer shells tend to want to take in more electrons or want to bond with more electrons. Now, atoms with 4 or 5 electrons in their outer shell tend to share their electrons. They'll bond by a covalent bond. So if we have 4 or 5 electrons in the outer shell, that will tend to be more of a covalent bond, and we think of carbon. Carbon has 4 in its outer shell, and it tends to bond covalently. Now, when we looked at carbon bonding with hydrogen, we saw how symmetrical it was. But remember that when we look at a hydrogen bond, we see there's asymmetry there. In the water molecule, we see it's oxygen with the hydrogens on one side. So that asymmetry lends itself to more of a polar experience as well. And remember that a hydrogen bond is not hydrogen atoms bonded together. Remember, a hydrogen, if we put 2 hydrogens together, we call this a what bond? Good. It's a covalent bond. Remember, a hydrogen bond is going to be a bond between 2 what molecules? Remember Mickey and Minnie? They represented what molecules? You got it. Between 2 water molecules. So don't get confused if you see on the test. A hydrogen bond means 2 hydrogens being bonded together. No, no, no. That's a covalent bond. A hydrogen bond means 2 water molecules sort of bumping into each other. Now, speaking of water, water is fascinating because it's wet and it's also wild. Water is wet. It's a great evaporative coolant. That's why your body uses water as a way of cooling you down through your sweat. Water also has high cohesion. There's that co again. It means bringing together, right? Cooperate, cohabitate. So cohesion is going to be a quality of water, whereby you're going to be having a lot of the ability for the water to actually be with another water molecule. So they bond to that other water molecule fairly tightly. Even though we said it's a weak bond, nonetheless it's a good cohesive bond. That's why bugs can walk on the water, because they're light enough and there's also that cohesion that water has. So cohesion is the attraction between one substance and itself. So that's those bonds of the water molecules. Water is also wet because it has adhesion. It bonds with other substances. If you put water in a glass, you notice that it will cling to the side of the glass. Or if you have a, let's see, what's another good example? Plants sucking up water. Plants suck up water because there's adhesion of the water to the side of the root of the plant. There's also the fact that water has cohesion. There's an attraction between it, so that it can be sucked up by the plant. Now, water is wild because it's less dense as a solid, and that's wild. Everything else, if you think of it, if you think of a steel ball, an iron ball, and you think of molten iron, if you were to take that steel ball and drop it into molten iron, heated up iron, the ball would just drop right to the bottom and eventually become molten iron as well. So usually a solid is going to be heavier or denser than its liquid counterpart. But water is not that way. Water is actually lighter when it's a solid, which is very, very wild and odd. Why? Why is this? Well, because when water freezes, when the temperature of the molecule gets down to 0 degrees centigrade or 32 degrees Fahrenheit, the molecules tend to create like a tent. And so they freeze in this tent-like arrangement. And this then allows for the water to float. So we got that floating of the ice cube, for instance, in our ice. So we'll conclude here with this, and I'll see you again on another Biology on the Beach. It's Dr. Leo Stoddard saying, hope you enjoyed that. Bye now.